Welcome to the Crozier Vision podcast. It is Tuesday, the 5th of July, 2011, and I'm joined by Antoine Clark, who blogs at Norlanto Review and occasionally Samizdata, but is probably best known for being, until recently, London's resident French libertarian. Antoine, we're going to talk about the occupation of the Ruhr. Can I start by outlining what I know about that chapter in history? Because what happened? You had the First World War, that ended, Germany lost, France and the Allies won. You had the Treaty of Versailles, which said that Germany had to pay huge reparations, I believe £6.6 billion, or £1920 as it was. And the Germans didn't pay, or wouldn't pay. And then in 1923 the French got fed up with this and said, right, okay, we'll take the Ruhr. So they occupied the Ruhr, along with the Belgians, I think. And they didn't get the money, and about 6 months later they left. Is that right?
Yes, I'm afraid so. There was also an element of trying to get... The thing to realise with France and Germany is that the border... if you look at a map of France's eastern border at any time over the last 600 years... It does tend to move backwards and forwards quite a bit. And, I mean, there was an element there as well of the whole Saar problem, whether Saar should join France or not. There was a local referendum.
Now, Saar is a fairly small region right on the modern-day border, and indeed right on the border then. And it's coal-rich.
Yes, it is. And, I mean... You know, if you're looking at ethnicity, they're practically the same people as the Alsace people. So it is a question of which side of the mountain, of one mountain or another, you're talking about. It is an area that, I mean, they had a referendum where they chose to stay in Germany.
Well, massively.
I mean, I think it was well over 90%. Mm. It was a sort of Saddam Hussein approval rating when he was in charge. Level, although I don't think
at a time when Hitler was in charge of Germany, and I think after the Night of the Long Knives too. So
yeah, I mean, it was big. So France had ambitions of stretching the border a little bit, but I mean, it was all of this came down to, I mean, the truth is several hundred years of revanchism. I mean,
You better explain what you mean by revanchism.
Revanchism is something. It's something that. The British are more likely to be the objects of than to have for historic reasons. Although within Britain, I think it would be fair to say that if you want to understand an element of Scottish nationalism, there's an element there of revanchism. It is basically the succession of bitter defeats that causes venom in a society. And in the 19th century, both Germany and France... basically inflicted on each other enormous national humiliations, which led to, you know, the next war being a "we're going to get you for last one." Now, in the case of the,
I'm struggling to think about the, because I know the obviously Napoleon crushed the Prussians in the 1804 something like
no,
that.
No, the big one is Jena.
Jena, yeah.
Jena, where, I mean, basically the King of Prussia leading his army has to surrender.
Yes.
I mean, that it doesn't get more utter humiliation than that. The Prussian army has to surrender in the field to Napoleon.
Right.
And by the way, they built a railway station, a bridge, you know, they really pile it on in Paris. You know, there's the Pont d'Jena and all this. They're not going to forget about it. It's inscribed on the Arc de Triomphe. I'm actually genuinely surprised the Germans didn't demolish that during the Second World War. But that was a pivotal point in Prussian history. They decided that they'd been rather complacent. They'd had the Kaiser...
Friedrich William, right.
You know, they'd had Frederick the Great...
And we'll be talking about Charlemagne in a minute.
No, but they had Frederick the Great, and there was the Prussian military supremacy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I think there was a sort of assumption it was still there in the early 19th century. Jena ended that. There was no There was no idea that Prussia is superior militarily to France. That was out of the window. And there was a strong sense to which the Franco-Prussian War was Prussia's revenge for Jena. Now,
70 years or 60 years on.
Yes.
When almost no one alive then was alive now.
Practically, very few people were alive. But I would note that Victor Hugo wrote a poem about Waterloo, and he was still quite active at the time of the Franco-Prussian War. So if he had been German, he would certainly have thought about it. And I say this because, of course, I have French relatives who have told me about their childhood of their being born in the early 20th century and being told as a 5-year-old, you exist, you were created, you were conceived for the purpose of getting Alsace and Lorraine back. And there's a whole, in the French middle class especially,
to point out to those listeners who aren't entirely familiar with history, Alsace-Lorraine was part of France. In 1870 they went to war with Prussia, they lost the war and lost Alsace-Lorraine.
Yes, they lost Alsace-Lorraine among other things. And one of the things that comes up is reparations. But yes, Alsace-Lorraine becomes part of Germany, except for one fort, Belfort, which was the only fort that didn't fall to the Germans during the 1870-1871. Well, on that border, they lost Metz, Toul, and Verdun, which was the first time France had lost those in 400 years. I mean, it was quite catastrophic. 300 years. But the Second Empire collapsed because of the end of the Prussian War. Where the commune.
This is Louis Napoleon we're talking about.
Napoleon III, yes. I mean, he actually surrenders to the Prussians. It is a perfect
reversal.
Reversal for Jena. But the mismanagement with which the war was perceived caused a revolution in Paris, which rapidly overthrew the Second Empire. But then
this has occurred to me, because after the First World War, there's revolutions in Germany too. So another.
Yes. And the interesting thing is that Paris was pro-war, but most of the rest of France wasn't at this point. And so then there was.
You mean they hadn't already lost? I thought.
Paris was besieged by, first of all, the Germans. And then there was a civil war where Paris was besieged by the rest of France with German support. I mean, at one point, the Germans were bombarding Paris to help the Versailles regime take over.
Is what people know and is referred as the Paris Commune.
The Paris Commune. Right. I mean, the Paris Commune, the Paris Commune has all sorts of origins, some of which are to do with the emergence of communism, but the trigger is protest at surrender and the exorbitant reparations that were demanded. I mean, yes, there was the handing over of Alsace and Lorraine, which, by the way, meant 1/5 of French coal and iron reserves were being handed over to Germany. And with it,
I must confess, I've heard that argument before, and I've heard that argument in relation to what happened to Germany after the First World War. I always wonder if that's true. I always wonder if natural resources make you rich, because it seems to me in the world, all those places which have lots of resources like oil and gas and coal and steel, we obviously still have the natural resource, iron ore, are really rotten places to live, like Saudi Arabia and Russia and. Well, maybe not Australia or Canada, but...
Australia, Canada.
Well, they are the exceptions, by and large. I mean, it seems to me, if you look at this, what's happening in the Middle East, it's the places which don't have oil where the rebellions are succeeding. Every place like which really has a lot of oil, like Saudi Arabia or Iran, they can repress the people really quite easily. If they don't have the oil, they've got a problem. So I always wonder about that argument about whether this losing of the natural resources is so bad. I mean, is it perceived? If it's perceived at a political level, that's a problem. But if it's not really a problem, then...
No, where it was perceived as a problem is for the next war.
Ah, yes.
That's where the problem lies. The French are going to fight the next war with one-fifth less coal and iron reserves.
Yes, yes.
Which, of course, was one of the reasons for doing it. But the other thing is the little matter of the 5 billion gold francs that France had to hand over in 3 years, and the 200 million gold francs that Paris had to pay as ransom to the Germans. Then there is, of course, this was a politically daft move. The proclamation of the German Empire was done in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles.
Right, yes, yes.
Yeah. This is any England football supporter will understand the sort of symbolism this has. It's a bit like going to celebrate an England World Cup victory in the middle of Berlin. I mean, it's in football.
Well,
in
terms, I seem to remember there was in the 96 Euro thing when Germany won on penalties. One of the Germans, and I don't blame him for doing this, really rubbed it in. He sort of, you know, he was really winding up the English supporters afterwards by my over exuberance celebrations.
Exactly.
So I sort of had.
The thing is that the commune partly exists because, generally speaking, the French army is discredited as an institution because, with a couple of exceptions, they've been perceived to have let the country down. The exceptions being the holding of Balfour, which was not considered a particularly strong fort compared with some of the others that did fall. And then there's also the fact that Paris tried to keep on fighting. And so there's a sense of, well, hang on, they're going to surrender to the Germans. They're giving up bits of France. And another thing was that the German army was insisting on having the right to march through Paris as one of the clauses of the French.
On a permanent basis? Or
No, but they were also going to occupy all the forts around Paris, a couple of which are still there. And all of this did help create this movement of no, Paris isn't going to give in like that. And the Paris Commune, to a certain extent, starts this way. In fact, the trigger for the actual uprising was when the provisional government tried to confiscate the 200 odd cannons that the people of Paris had actually paid for as their contribution to the defence. And the Parisians said, no, these are our cannons. The government can't take them away. And as there were an estimated 500,000 firearms in the capital as well, they basically said no. And yes, it became a social revolution as well. And that reflects the fact that Paris was an enormous city compared with the rest of the country. I mean, I think it's... off the top of my head, it's something like 1 in 6 people in France lived in Paris at the time. It was an enormous... France...
Well, probably more than now, isn't it?
Yes, because, I mean, France... half the population of France lived outside towns as recently as 1936. So in 1870, the figure would have been quite a bit greater. So Paris was the enormous metropolis for the country. And the rest of the country... The towns were really quite small, which is still, generally speaking, the case today. Revolutions in Paris, that tends to be where they happen. And if they succeed in Paris, there's a good chance they'll succeed at a national level simply because of the sheer weight of Paris compared with the rest of the country. And that's why that happens. But... one of the things that's interesting is that despite having just lost a war, despite the fact there's been a civil war that's happened afterwards, there was a sense of... and the fact there was a German army of occupation in certain parts of France until the reparations were paid off.
And how long was that?
2.5 years.
Oh, so they paid it all off in 2.5 years.
They paid the lot off in 2.5 years.
Because my understanding is that one of the claims about those reparations, you said, was it 6 million or 6 billion?
5 billion.
5 billion gold francs. And how much is a gold franc in terms of gold?
Well, I mean, I can tell you how much that's... In pure gold weight, a 20 franc gold coin now is worth £180. So that would be...
This looks like a really complicated...
I mean, I think it's something like 9 billion. I think it's something like £9 billion pounds at the time, or something like that.
Right. Seeing as there wasn't much inflation between then and 1920, and the Germans only had to pay £6.6 billion pounds, and they paid off in 2.5 years.
Yes, in fact, considering the new government was actually quite unpopular, especially with Paris, but because it had surrendered to the Germans. The one thing, however, that was popular was let's pay up and get the Germans out as fast as possible. And basically, the government had asked for two loans. The second one of which was oversubscribed 13 times. call out the loans.
I'm struggling to think how people must have done this, because in 1870 people were substantially poorer than they were in 1920.
Get them out.
Wow, and people must have been, old ladies must have been selling their houses and all the...
It was, get them out. Yeah. And I mean, I can give you a couple of things to give you an idea of the mentality of the day. In my great-great-grandparents on the French side would have said after a decent meal, there's another one the Prussians won't get. Because for a few years they were tightening their belts to make sure they... everyone just coughed up the money. This wasn't even a tax, by the way. This was a government loan. The purpose of the loan was pay the Germans to get the hell out as part of the surrender agreement. Now, you get a sense of there's a determination going on, but now you've got to realise that same determination was then, okay, now payback. And there is...
This is something I wanted to ask. I've never quite understood whether the French antipathy towards Germany was really all to do with Alsace-Lorraine, or it was the reparations. But then, because the reparations went on for a long time, but if it was over fairly quickly, I think it must have been...
It was over fairly quickly. But it was over fairly quickly because it was, let's get this over with. You know, it was let's have our teeth
pulled out. But equally, presumably there were all sorts of problems with the government actually repaying this loan over the next sort of 40 years or...
Yes, I mean, one of the... the only thing that surprises me about the Third Republic is that it existed at all and that it survived for 5 years.
It lasted until 1940.
It did. I mean, as French political systems go, it was rather one of the more successful. And it's astonishing because it was absolutely loathed from the left to the right. I mean, just about anyone could find something to criticise with it. I mean, for a start, for 4 years, it basically didn't admit what it was. If you look at the Republic was only declared in about 1874. In the previous time, it was basically a military government with a nominally elected government which had fairly repressive powers. I mean, they went and shot 20,000 communards at least. maybe 30 in a week.
So 20,000 in a week. Were the communards shooting back at the time?
No, these are the executions. These are the executions. They called it the Bloody Week.
Well, yes. Goodness.
Some people say it was as many as 30,000. I'm saying 20 years is a sort of median estimate. The minimum estimate is 10,000.
I'm staggered that something like this is happening in a country not a million miles away from us in the 1870s.
Well, now you get a sense of why this was... such a venomous time. I mean, like I say, it is astonishing the Third Republic gets going because the government, the provisional government bases itself in Versailles, which symbolically is dubious to say the least, yes. Not least because that's where the Germans have proclaimed their empire. So, I mean, if you wanted to decry them as Prussian stooges, it's a pretty obvious one to do. And from Versailles, they marched on Paris. I mean, La Défense, there was a bit of fighting there.
That's the bit with the modern buildings.
Yes, well, in the middle of it, there's a monument to the Paris resistance against the Germans, because there was a fort right next to it, one of the forts that surround Paris. And
That's where it gets its name from.
Yeah, I always thought it was La Défense, because La Défense has other meanings in French, one of which is a tusk. And I always thought it was a reference to the fact that it's like a tusk sticking out from Paris. But in fact, no, it is to do with the defence of Paris in 1870. I mean, there was a siege of Paris in the winter. That was the one, I think that was on with the Germans. And then in 1871, there was then the Commune, which followed that. So there were two sieges of Paris. I mean... This is a seriously bloody time. This is the time when Parisians learned to eat horse, cats, dogs, mice, rats. I certainly have had a relative who I think my great-great-grandmother fed my great-grandfather some rat to keep when he was a small child, but wouldn't eat any herself because she couldn't spare the meat. You know, I mean, it was that bad a time. And then, so when his son was born, you know, he was drilling him, you know, you exist to reconquer Alsace-Lorraine. And the joke is he wasn't even particularly anti-German. I mean, he actually studied German at university, he actually visited Germany. He was a school headmaster. He corresponded with people in Germany, but as far as he was concerned, there must be a war, and France must smash Germany to get Alsace-Lorraine back. And indeed, he signed up in 1914, and was wounded in the fighting. So I mean, this is the interesting thing, is that there's a certain amount of I wouldn't call it admiration. There's respect for Germany, but there is a deep-seated sense of there is an injustice that needs to be overcome. I mean, one country where I think of it in recent years that has affected Britain is, of course, Argentina's attitude to the United Kingdom over the Falklands. I mean, it is noticeable that in recent months there's been a certain amount of saber rattling. Where, I mean, the obvious thing, if you're the leader of the opposition in Argentina, say, what are you doing to get the Falklands back, or Malvinas, as they would call it? And the answer, the government's honest answer, would have to be not much. To which the instant accusation is, well, that proves you must go and somebody else must take over. I mean, in Argentina, it is a potential source of instability to whatever government's in charge. And there was a sense of that going on from the 1870s through to 1914.
And this would explain things like...
the Dreyfus Affair.
Oh, it would?
The Dreyfus
Affair. I've never understood what was going on with the Dreyfus Affair.
Well, the
Dreyfus... Which explained to the...
I'll
give you my schoolboy version, then you can correct it.
Fine, okay.
Alfred Dreyfus was a major in the French army, and... He knew something about the 75 gun, which was incredibly important. Anyway,
he was one of the quartermasters. He had access to the details of every one of the weapons he had access to documents about all the weapons in the French army. So if one was trying to recruit a spy, he would indeed have been exactly the right person to recruit. It has to
And he was Jewish at a time when... I mean, anti-Semitism was
particularly strong.
Common, and papers appeared in the waste paper basket of the German military attaché.
Yeah,
and Dreyfus was arrested, tried, convicted. It was ceremonially humiliated, sent to Devil's Island, and then Emile Zola said, "No, this is nonsense." And there was a whole campaign against it, saying this guy's entirely innocent. It's a fix-up. And eventually he was released. And even to this day, there's a suspicion over it. And but it also tore France apart at the time.
Oh, it tore France apart at
the time. There's a wonderful cartoon of people at a dinner, and they're having a very polite dinner, and then all of a sudden someone mentions Dreyfus. And the next picture is them all fighting one another. So
it was like that. My great-grandfather was wrote in a newspaper, and he was twice challenged to a duel over the Dreyfus affair. This was that's what it was like. But had it been, let's say, had he been accused of spying for Spain, which has a border with France, there have been some wars between France and Spain, it would have been nothing like the problem. The problem was that this was spying for Germany. I mean, of all the countries in the world well, in fact, there was a spy working for Germany, and it turned out that the person who was the real culprit basically had gambling debts, and he was being blackmailed, and that's how he ended up working for the Germans. I mean, of all the countries to spy for, at the time, I think Britain would have been the other really bad one to have picked. But I mean, it coloured things. Like, for example, the why did France become more friendly with Britain? Because it was all part of what was absolutely needed. You know, we've got a choice. We can continue the ancestral hatred of Britain, or
Joe, we have one wars on one front only.
Yeah,
but it's also presumably also because Britain had changed its views. I mean, Germany was building a navy, and the British really didn't like that. Because I understand the Entente Cordiale, what's that, 1905? It's quite an astonishing document, because all of a sudden all the disputes the French and the British could have, they got rid of.
And it's noticeable. There are incidents that are completely forgotten in this country. The Fashoda incident.
Yes.
To be fair, I think in France now it's almost completely forgotten. But at the time, it was a very big deal in France. To recap, what it was is there was a British expedition basically mapping from, the idea was to build a Cairo to Cape Town railway. And the French, as it happens, were doing an expedition from Dakar to Djibouti, which is on the Red Sea. And it just so happens that the two forces that were more or less staking claims to bits of Sudan met at a point called Fashoda. And both sides actually sensibly, and this is where communications came in, because they could communicate back to Paris and London to decide, are we going to fight over this, or is one of us going to give way? And the French government said, give way, because they wanted good relations with Britain. The big picture for them.
So about 1897, something like that?
Yes. But they neglected to inform the population of France that this was the reasoning. And so there was a big dispute over it. I mean, had there been a military coup, it would have been supported by a lot of people in France over that issue alone. I mean, that issue would have been considered a perfectly justifiable reason for getting rid of the Third Republic, as indeed were about 10 others in the previous 10 years. But it was big. If it hadn't been for Alsace-Lorraine, there would probably have been a war between Britain and France over that incident, without the Franco-Prussian War. So that's an indirect consequence right there. It also comes into it transforms French society in so many ways. I mean, as it happens, France in the early part of the 20th century, there's a lot of industry developing in places like Bordeaux, quite a bit further away from the.
Developing.
But the one of the problems France has, of course, is at the start of the First World War, still a lot of the steel and coal is right along the border with Belgium. The
British army fought a big battle over a coal mine, so...
Yes, I mean, the whole Lille, Maubeuge, that sort of area, that's where a lot of French industry was. I mean, one of the extraordinary things is how France managed to fight the First World War at all, given that in the initial stage they were losing large chunks of territory that's where their factories were. But there was an element of spreading them around a bit. I mean, it is an extraordinary time. But when the Germans started saying, "Oh, we can't pay these reparations; they're too high," there was a sentiment in France after the First World War in France. Well, we paid ours, one, and two. If you're not happy with the amount of destruction you've caused, you should have surrendered earlier. I mean. If the Germans had decided after the failure of the Marne offensive that actually they weren't going to get their quick victory by Christmas, nobody would have asked them for anything like the amount of damages they were asked for. So, I could say if you don't do the crime, you don't.
There's just two quite astonishing facts to me. One is that if I can remember what I was talking about, I don't remember what I said, but. It's the fact that these were reparations, which history has, it's the schoolboy history version of history says, oh, these reparations were unpayable. It looks like they were. They were very eminently payable, had the Germans chosen to.
It has to be said, though, that the Germans imposed their reparations on France in the expectation France wouldn't be able to pay them. That seems to be perfectly clear, that the whole idea of the reparations, because the idea was a German army would stay in France until they were paid off. the bit that the Germans got right, if you like, was to insist that their troops would stay there until the money was paid.
I mean, I guess that's the problem in the case of the after the First World War is, well, we didn't conquer Germany.
No, that's right.
So we couldn't. So.
And that works both ways. Both in Germany, there's a sense of, well, in what sense have we lost? Our armies are on foreign territory everywhere.
Yep.
Therefore, it's not the army that's lost this war. It's the civilians. It's the government. It's the stab in the back and all of this. So I can completely understand where that propaganda is coming from. I mean, there's an element of appearance that backs them up. But there's the other thing is that, well, hang on, what if we don't pay? I mean, if there's nobody enforcing it, why should we? Whereas there were German troops actually stationed in the north and east parts of France during the 2.5 odd years that it took to actually cough up.
I mean, it's almost beginning to sound like reparations are almost a contract. It's not so much that it's a sort of deal, not particularly between governments, but between the people and their government. In that, if you want your reparations to get paid, well, you want people who want to pay them, if you see what I mean, who feel sort of guilty or feel... I'm not sure the French didn't feel guilty after age 70.
No, there was no guilt about it, but I can assure you. What there was is a sense of, these guys are here, they must go, And the best way to get
it's really occupation then. That was what was doing it.
Yeah.
So in that case, why didn't the Ruhr occupation succeed?
I think the big difference is the First World War had been such a devastation that ultimately there was an element of bluff. I think everybody knew the French weren't really going to resume the First World War. Over a delay in reparations. And then, of course, there was this whole question of what to do about inflation and what if the communists take over, which is a new problem. I mean, I suppose there is an element to which the Prussians probably did loosen up a little bit with the provisional government in France over when the Commune happened. Because if the Commune hadn't happened, the Germans might have been a bit more strict about their enforcement. But there's a sense of, do we really want those guys? Do we want the Spartacists, to take over What on earth are they going to do? So that's, I think, there's an element of which the fear of Bolshevism has already started to cause people to readjust what they're prepared to do. And also the millions of dead men, I mean, in Europe. You know, are we really prepared to resume the fight? Can we? I mean, there's a...
Well, presumably at the time, France would have found it fairly easy because the German army is down to 100,000. It presumably wouldn't have offered much of a threat. So I'm guessing they could have done.
Well, maybe. But whether the French government could have done it politically was the problem.
Oh, the French had gone soft.
Well, it's not a question of soft. I mean, they've just been... You know, I mean... If you've been on trains and the metro in France, have you ever noticed the priority seating arrangements? You know, you have the signs for these seats are in priority four. Well, the number one priority in France isn't pregnant women, it's not people with shopping, it's mutilés de guerre, war wounded. Mm. And there's a reason for that. There were an awful lot of them. One of the jokes you always standard French comedy jokes was the old timer veteran, you know, a bit like Dad's army, who said I was at Verdun. The problem was they all were at Verdun because every regiment was there. I mean, the French lost 500,000 killed in that one battle. That one battle in 1916 at Verdun cost 500,000 French. I mean, there's 1 million dead in that battle. You know, where the will to risk starting that again was just unsustainable. I mean,
I think just as a comparison, Britain lost about 160,000 in the Somme. So that's as a comparison. So,
and that was traumatic enough in this country. Yes, I mean these are, but that was staggered out over nearly a year because the Battle of Verdun lasted virtually the whole of 1916. And what's more, they were actually trying not to lose. They weren't doing the sort of suicide wave attacks.
They'd run out of men by that stage, hadn't they?
That they'd done in 1914. But it is, you know, when you think of that, you know, my grandfather wrote an autobiographical booklet in which he described his childhood during the First World War, where you're in a town in which he wondered, he'd almost started wondering if women ever wore anything other than black, because there were only women in the town and they were all wearing black because every single one of them had at least one, and in many cases several, you know, they were mourning for several people. I mean, it was that bad.
I always carry around the statistics, sort of some of the statistics with me, because I believe that the British Empire of 80 million people lost 1 million dead in the war, whereas France of 40 million people lost 1.5 million. So massively, completely different scale. That's 2-3 times as much.
And I mean, you take my great-grandfather who didn't die in the First World War, he died 6 years later, but he had been gassed, and so he was in fact war wounded. He's not in the 1.5 million, but he is actually to a certain extent incapacitated by it, and you know, that is a factor that comes into it. It's just the sheer scale of all that, and then the socially, because the classes in society that tended to get hit the most, it was the junior officer class that tended to get wiped out because they were the first ones over the trenches, and proportionately other social classes, for example anyone who was working in farming or industry had a better chance of not being sent to the front. And unlike the Second World War, the First World War, it is the people at the front who are being slaughtered. And France is one of the countries where demographics as a social science was developed, partly because they were watching the emergence of Germany during the 19th century and the relative decline of France in Europe. But, I mean, if you look at the population pyramids for the 1920s, they are quite frightening when you see these great big gaps. Yes. And then you see the gaps where the children would be, you know, the missing children from this. And this obsessed French public policy.
20 years later is 1940, when they'd all been, yes.
Yes. And so you've got 80-year-old generals. That's another thing you get. You get 80-year-old marshals running the country because the 50-year-old, well, he was a lieutenant who would have been there. He was the lieutenant who got killed in the first 5 seconds of the Battle of the Marne. Yeah. This does have an effect. Now, I've painted a relatively French view of the revanchism, but of course, the rise of Hitler is primarily, I think, actually a revanchism. I don't think that anti-Semitism was the main thrust of why a lot of people in Germany supported him, either enthusiastically or thought, yes, he'll do. I think there's an element of the way the German left had been anti-war veteran. They'd more or less said the war veterans were wankers for fighting for the bourgeoisie. And, well, if you're a war widow, that's not the sort of thing you want to hear. And, by the way, if you're a mutilated war veteran, that's not what you definitely don't want to hear. And so I think the left... the Marxist left in Germany were starting from a weak position with that. So there's an element of we were betrayed with the whole thing about we're not occupied. There's a sense of the French only beat us because of the massive American and British help. And of course, there's the territory, you know, Alsace and Lorraine, which, as far as they're concerned, a part of Germany, has now been, the other bits, probably more emotional, I suspect.
The Saar and...
I'm thinking of the Danzig corridor, because, of course, that was indeed more exploited for propaganda purposes by the Nazis. I think they probably did make rather more of the Polish borders than the French borders. Yes. Partly because the French borders had actually, most of Alsace-Lorraine had actually been French for a couple of hundred years, as opposed to, 15 years in the case of Danzig. So I think that's where it comes in. But that's where revanchism is a problem. Yeah.
So, where do we stand today?
Well, if you want to know, well, it's funny you say that because I'm now based in Paris. And I recently had some work which involved me at a day's notice having to get on a train to go to Belgium or Germany. And of course, I can turn up at the railway station 10 minutes before the train leaves, buy a ticket, get on the train. The only reason I need a passport is because I need something to show security at the building I'm going into. And away I go. And... basically, all of that is about stopping these types of things happening.
But is this a top-down thing, or is it also a bottom-up thing? I mean, do the French have any bones to pick with the Germans? Do the Germans have any bones to pick with the French these days?
Not particularly.
The Germans have learned to accept.
I don't know about the Germans. I don't know about the Germans. I think, though, partly in the case of Germany, that the occupation of large parts of the country by the Soviet Union concentrated mines considerably. I mean, the truth is the Red Army did a lot more damage to Germany than the Western Allies did. What this all does, I think, is gives a bit of context to why de Gaulle absolutely insisted that there would be a zone of occupation that the French would have in Germany.
I'm always amazed they managed to get away with that, considering presumably the Free French forces were minuscule. But
well, yes, they were. But although, what was the interesting thing is that the French army until the Algerian War certainly was entirely American equipped. This wasn't a problem at all until the Algerian War. But it was all about the mistake the French saw that they'd made at the end of the First World War. Okay, there was a sense of maybe we did push it too hard. Germany was more devastated in 1918 than France had been in 1871. So yes, a certain amount of proportionality there. But the other thing was, we let Germany rearm, and we weren't on the spot. It's interesting that when France pulled out of the military structure in NATO, they didn't in any way decide that they were pulling out of their bases in Germany. They kept those running, even though they weren't part of the NATO command structure, because that's not what it was about. The borders between France and Germany are fairly reasonably recognised. I don't think that there is a sense that there was simply so much damage done on both sides that the price of another war like this is just too high.
It's too high. Antoine, we're out of time. Thank you very much.